Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's be honest. When you're in a loving relationship, you often do things for your partner that you'd rather not do, because that's love. But have you ever gotten a request from your significant other that might go a little too far? Judith Newman did, and she writes about it in her essay, He's Going Back to His Former Wife, Sort of. It's read by Marissa Tomei, who's starring now in The Rose Tattoo on Broadway.
There's something I have to tell you, John said. Do you remember ever wanting to hear the sentence after that one? I don't. There's something I have to tell you has never, in the history of man, been followed by, we won the lottery, or I have discovered a cure for blindness. This is especially true when the person uttering that sentence is your husband, and he is about to die. I'm not a big believer in deathbed confessions. I intend to keep it all to myself, unless my own, there's something I have to tell you, is, you were always my favorite, to whoever walks in the room. Everybody should be at my deathbed. You won't regret it. John and I were lying in the cramped hospital bed that I had installed in my bedroom because I had decided to go full pioneer woman and tend to him myself. I'm still not sure why. Normally, I'm the queen of outsourcing. Also, I'm a terrible nurse. But my decision to care for him at home was made in an instant. He wanted to be here. Our 16-year-old twin boys desperately wanted him here. And so did I, despite the fact that this was the first time we had lived together in 25 years of marriage. We had always kept separate homes. A week earlier, we had learned that John had three separate forms of cancer: pancreatic, liver, and prostate. A cancer overachiever, as I told him. I can't remember the Yiddish phrase his doctor used to describe the usefulness of chemo or radiation, but it roughly translated to pissing in the wind. Solid, barrel-chested, bearded, floppy-haired, John had always looked like a Bugs Bunny cartoon version of the opera singer he was. I adored his looks. Now he was a skeleton. John spoke with difficulty as he held my hand. So, there's something I have to tell you, he said. I made a certain promise to Amy. Amy was his former wife. She had died of breast cancer about 30 years ago, before John and I met. I promised her, he said, that we would be buried together. Oh. It turns out that when John said he had kept Amy close, he hadn't been speaking metaphorically. She was in his closet, at his studio apartment. Could I fetch her? Also, could I find her passport and death certificate? I would need them to carry out his plan. There was a field in northern England where John had played as a child. He wanted to be buried there, with Amy, but not scattered. The field still existed, but the area was no longer so rural, and John didn't want to end up blanketing a local parking lot. So, I was to take his box of ashes and Amy's, get a shovel, and probably a flashlight, because this was illegal, so we'd need to do it at night. The funeral equivalent of a dine and dash. Joining me would be John's 90-year-old sister and his nephew, along with our sons, Henry and Gus, who are currently far more focused on the adventure of the illicit burial than on what it all meant. "I'd always been sure you'd go first," John added sadly. The fact that I am 30 years younger had in no way deterred him from this thought. John seemed the grumpiest of men, but in key ways he was an optimist. "And of course I would have followed your instructions for your own burial," he said. "I would have cremated you and placed you in the mausoleum with your parents. I know you wanted nothing more." This didn't seem the time to point out that for at least 10 years I had been telling him that I loathed the mausoleum, that I had arranged for my body to be donated to a medical school, and that I had put aside money for a big party afterward. John never listened. That, combined with his almost comical frugality — I had already been warned I would need to find the cheapest cremation place in New York — had often threatened to sink our marriage. But I guess I could save that conversation to have with myself late at night. Plenty of time for that. Not much time for anything else. We talked and talked. "I was a good husband, wasn't I?" he said. "At least I didn't chase after girls." "No," I thought, a little churlishly, "because then you would have had to pay for them." "You were wonderful," I said. Both thoughts were true. He wanted to make sure I understood his plan. But about 30 minutes into this conversation, he suddenly looked sheepish, as if it had just occurred to him that his wife of 25 years may not actually be on board to carry out this promise he had made to his former wife more than 3 decades earlier. "You don't have to do this right away," he said. "In fact, you could wait until you go, then have the boys take all 3 of us. That would be fine, too." I said. Amy was Midwestern, blonde, aristocratic, and gracious, an accomplished equestrian and mezzo-soprano, 17 years older than John. Before she got sick, they had worked their way across Europe, singing at all the big opera houses. She was everything I am not. John and I used to joke that the only thing he and I had in common was a mutual hatred of fish. Amy and John shared everything. He loved us both, and he made a family with me. But I never kid myself. I explained the situation to my friend Hillary over lunch, including the part where I could hold off on the burial until my own demise. "I really don't want to be their ashy third wheel," I groused. "Here's what you do," Hillary said. "You put Amy in some sort of suspicious container, something metal that the TSA people can't see through in the screening. Amy looks like a bomb. Oops, the TSA will just have to keep her. Oh, well, you tried." I could have explained instead of laughing, I suppose. But it's hard without sounding saccharine. One of the things I loved about my husband was that he kept his promises. Even stupid ones that made no difference to anyone but himself. You wanted a light bulb changed? It was going to be changed, exactly at the time he said. And it would be with the 60-watt bulb, not the 100, because who the hell knows? He had his reasons. This punctiliousness and attention to detail meant he didn't make promises freely. And he said no to life far more often than he said yes. But also, this reliability was at the center of his John-ness. He lived small, but he loved deep. John couldn't quite remember where Amy's papers were, but he knew they were in his apartment, and I did too, since he threw out nothing. During the search, I found other things I wanted to ask him about. Why did my peace-loving husband have a police summons for disorderly conduct in 2002 that he never mentioned to me? Why were there photos of him happily rowing a woman I had never heard about in a pond in Central Park? And why was she dressed as a mime? By the time I decided to ask, he could no longer speak. He had the most beautiful voice, a basso profondo. And I am glad our last conversations did not involve the police or mysterious mimes. I found the papers in about 30 seconds. He didn't even need to tell me where he put them. I knew my husband. John died 3 days later, on his 86th birthday, which, since he was a fan of order and symmetry, seemed purposeful. My son Henry's response when I broke the news, "Well, the good news is, now you get to be the favorite parent." In August, Henry, Gus, and I will be headed to England. The cremation was super cheap, and the container is plastic. I have gotten 4 Newcastle United stickers so that Henry can decorate it with his favorite team. Amy and her papers are with us, too. I will let my sons carry John, and I will carry Amy. I want her to get there safely. She has been waiting to join John for a long time. Though I doubt he ever said to her, "Hey, do you want to be secretly buried in an English field in the middle of nowhere?" In my life, I have been so lucky. Though I do wonder, is this my love story? Is it theirs? Maybe it's ours.
That's Marissa Tomei reading Judith Newman's essay, "He's Going Back to His Former Wife, Sort of." So did Judith carry out John's wish? We'll catch up with her after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Judith Newman wrote her modern love essay about the unusual request that John made near the end of his life. But she says that their relationship began in an unusual way, too.
I met John because he was an opera singer and he was a friend of the family. And he was a pal with my uncle. My uncle was always dragging him to our family occasions. And the joke in my family was that my mother thought he was cute, and she was always saying, you know, "Save him for me," which became like a little less funny later on. So I met him through my family. But how we actually started dating was I was dating a person named John. That person named John was in Europe. I got a postcard saying, "Meet you at such and such a place at such and such a time." And I did, not knowing who it was. And it turned out to be this John. So I suddenly found myself on a date with a person it never even dawned on me wanted to date me. And I was too embarrassed and polite to say, "What? You're kidding." So that's actually how we met.
Judith never told John the real story. It seemed like one of the harmless secrets that you sometimes keep in a marriage. And she says it's only fair because he never told her about Amy's ashes. And even though Judith didn't intentionally try to get those ashes confiscated by the TSA like her friend Hillary had suggested, it almost happened anyway.
Unbeknownst to me, even though I had Amy in a cardboard box, I didn't bother to look. And so she was actually in a metal container. So by the time I got to England, all of my stuff had been just dumped out by the TSA and thrown back in. And I suppose they believed, you know, John, being the kind of fastidious person he was, had written Amy's ashes on Amy's ashes. So I guess they believed it. They weren't going like, "Oh, that's suspicious." And they just put her back in. So thank God for that.
Judith did end up carrying out John's last wish.
My sons carried John and I carried Amy. We found this particular place through John's nephew. It was literally one of those over the field and through the woods situations. I took them with John's sister, who is 90 years old, and I experienced the humiliation of having a 90-year-old woman be able to hop a fence to get to this place, as compared to me, I had to have people haul me over it. It was a beautiful day. And yes, and I made sure that when we got them into this hole that John's nephew had dug, I made sure that their little ash cans touched each other. That was kind of important for me to do. I felt, and I continue to feel, a great tenderness, I suppose. I think how long she waited. I think that he was her true love. Interestingly, while I was about 30 years younger than John, she was about 17 or 18 years older. And he had taken care of her when she got sick. She had been married before, but I think that he was the person she loved above all else. And when we were sitting at dinner, I remember, you know, it was a beautiful day. It really was beautiful. And my son, my very sarcastic, sardonic son, who was 16 at the time, he turned to me and he said, "You know, I think that I'm going to be buried with Dad. So gorgeous here." And all I could think was, "No, Henry, you're not going to be buried with Dad because you're going to find your Amy. And I think we all need to."
Judith says she never saw John's last request as a betrayal.
I think that with the loves you have, there are always, if you're very, very lucky, you'll have a few. And they can give you different things. And John gave me children, and he gave me many things that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But he gave her something she wouldn't have had otherwise. And I do believe that theirs was a soulmate kind of love. Ours was different. And neither was more legitimate than the other.
Judith says that she does plan to go back to the field where she buried John and Amy. She keeps a video of the place on her phone. And she says that soon she'll be ready to start dating again.
My son is going away to school, and he's desperately frightened that I'm going to be lonely. He keeps asking me, "Am I going to date? Am I going to get a dog?" He says, "I know I'm coming back here, and there are going to be 5 golden retrievers in the house," which is a possibility. But I just haven't quite gotten there yet, but I will, and it will be a very different relationship the next time around. As old and crotchety as I am, I have complete confidence that I will find another person to love.
That's Judith Newman. She's a writer and author of To Siri with Love, A Mother, Her Autistic Son, and The Kindness of Machines. More after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
Well, it's always so delicate to talk about the death of a loved one. And, you know, most people do it in a way that is sober and respectful. And Judith does it not only with humor, but constant sense of humor. It's sort of funny from start to finish, but also touching. And what I find so refreshing about that is how it sort of demystifies death. It's not something that always has to be talked about so soberly and earnestly. You know, it's been said it's another phase in life. And it's just, you know, it happens to all of us. And their relationship was clearly this sort of clever, kidding, but loving relationship. And his death and how it was handled was in keeping with that, their way of relating, or so it seemed to me.
And here's Marissa Tomei explaining why she chose to read Judith's essay.
Because of the magnanimous heart that the author has, how she has room for the love for everyone that was in her husband's life. And also, I'm obsessed with death.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.